now stay tuned for To Your Health on WPBC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here's your host, MC Blair.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, good morning, good morning to you. Good Saturday morning on this crisp fall day. Having some great weather. And we've got a good show for you. Got an interview with Chef Jeff Deloff of Three Penny Grill. And that was an interview that myself and my co-host, Michael Riley, did. And so it went well, and it's really good. It's really, really heartening to see chefs in the area. There are several that are embracing the local food movement, the regenerative agriculture movement, serving that kind of food, which we know from experience and from research that that's real food, and that if you eat real food, you'll get healthy, or at least stay healthy if you're not healthy already. But if you're not healthy already, you'll get healthy, because food is medicine. But before we start, I wanted to say that I saw this research. My lovely bride, Marcia, helps me out by researching articles. And one of the articles she came up with was the 11 best benefits of peanut butter. Yeah, pretty cool, right? Now, we're not talking about the standard off-the-shelf peanut butter, because that's got so many additives, preservatives, and other nefarious ingredients that actually leach the nutrients from your body, as opposed to put nutrients into your body. So stay away from that. Stay away from keep with real peanut butter that you grind up in the various stores that are around that have true peanut butter. It's just flat peanuts, and you put it through a grinder, and then you eat it. And it's really, really good. So the health benefits include reduced risk of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, degenerative nerve diseases. It controls Alzheimer's disease, and it helps decreasing hypertension, of course, high blood pressure, and the risk of contracting viral and fungal infections. Pretty cool, right? It is a healthy food. It's full of nutrients, proteins, carbohydrates, monounsaturated fatty acids, folate, niacin, keeps going on and on and on, riboflavin, vitamin E, vitamin C, vitamin A, sodium, magnesium, calcium, manganese, goes on and on, selenium, copper, iron, and zinc. And unlike the costly nuts like cashews and pistachios, which are really good for you, and almonds and walnuts, peanuts are low cost and they offer similar benefits. And the first commercial preparation of peanut butters was in the United States in 1884. And according to an estimate by Kansas State University, the amount of peanut butter consumed by the United States alone in 1 year is enough to spread across the floor of the Grand Canyon. That's pretty good. And it's cool. We're right here in Charlottesville. Thomas Jefferson was a peanut farmer, as well as Jimmy Carter, right? So we got a couple of presidents that were peanut farmers. They knew. They really did know. So peanuts contain no saturated fats and can be consumed on a regular basis. They only contain unsaturated fats. This is good news for people who fear to gain weight by consuming peanuts. Peanuts actually help you lose weight. Now, I'm talking about just, you know, eating. I'm not talking about eating, you know, a 2 pounds of peanut butter at a sitting, because obviously if you just continually eat too much, you will still gain weight, because that's calorie intake in and calorie out, or calories burned going out. And the fat content is equal to that of fats found in olive oil. And so pretty cool, man. Prevents type 2 diabetes. Can also be beneficial in reducing the risk of type 2 diabetes, which, of course, as we know, is the diabetes that is caused by diet or unhealthy diet. So peanut butter is really cool all the way around. That's just a little side bit. Reduces blood sugar and really, really, really can help. Rich in dietary fiber. Good stuff. Good stuff. Good stuff. We're going to get to the interview here with Jeff Taloff, Chef Jeff Taloff, Chef Jeff from Three Penny Grill. If you haven't been, I suggest that you explore that. Pretty good place and really, really, really good, good food and very well prepared, I might add, as attested to by my co-host, Michael Riley. So without further ado, we should get to that interview. So here it is.
This is MC Blair, and I'm here with my co-host, Michael Riley. Hello, Michael.
Morning, I guess. This
good morning.
It's actually
sure.
afternoon right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, well,
everybody's
you know, we're,
listening, it'll be
it's a remote. We're talking with Chef Jeff Taloff of Three Penny Cafe, and he is devoted to locally sourcing whenever possible.
Okay.
Does that sum it up pretty much, Jeff?
Yeah, devoted is a pretty good word to use.
Okay.
It's kind of a long project that kind of carries itself. Once it's got started, there's really no way to turn back from it. So, yeah, devoted is a good word to use.
I would sort of revise that there, Jeff, knowing you now that I've known you now for quite some time and been coming here to Three Penny, that it's not really just whenever possible. It's almost always possible, I think, the way you kind of tend to approach things, right? I mean, you really seem to go out of your way to try to, I mean, as you can tell, we're looking at your list of producers here on the menu, and I know you've got some long and tight relationships with farmers around here like Wolf Creek and Automall Farm, Free Union, and so tell us, you know, I guess really the best place to start would be to give us an idea of what it is about what you do that has gotten you so devoted to sourcing this type of food.
I think just about, this is my 2-year anniversary coming up next month for being located here in Virginia and at Three Penny Cafe. And before that, I wasn't any different from any other chef out there. You know, I went through the same ordering channels that anybody else did without really giving any thought as to where food was coming from and how it was sourced. And there are a few moments of my previous restaurant that I worked at that I kind of can associate with what we do things now in terms of, you know, bacon being too fatty. And it's like, all right, that's it's a standard gripe that someone might have just ordering out of a box. Meat boxes, essentially. But you don't really think about, well, what is really in that piece of pork belly and how it gets to that point. It's not just about, well, it's too fatty or it's not this size. It's like there's a long, lengthy process of how meat starts from one point and ends up onto a dinner table through those conventional means. Once I took this job, I kind of did my own research on what's available in the food shed of Virginia. And there's a lot more than upstate New York, where I'm originally from, which is a shame because there's a ton of farmland. It's just not used to its full capacity. I think it's even harder up north, given the seasons are exceptionally shorter, and the price of actually growing anything in upstate New York is quite costly for what you get back.
Yeah, that's somewhat surprising. It's good to hear. I guess it's certainly a pat on the back for Virginia, because I always thought of upstate New York as a pretty, you know, sort of a rich agricultural area, and I know you're doing a lot with
that. You would think that it is an incredibly rich agriculture, and there are some parts that are. The watershed with the Finger Lakes is incredibly productive in terms of organics and small farms and things like that, but the majority of the state, we're looking at pastured land that is not suitable for growing crops that humans can consume, or it is just blatantly devoted to soy and corn production.
Right.
And as I'm guessing you probably have talked about before, the devastating effects of monocropping with just corn and soybeans and what that has to do on land and the land's value afterwards. And I think New York has this really strong push for the corn industry, and let's try to grow as much corn for ethanol production and plastics and things like that. And their tagline is like Grow New York or Corn New York or something, and they make biodegradable plastics with the corn. It's a lot of smoke and mirrors, but at the end of the day, they just want the ethanol production in upstate New York. And it's just not beneficial to farmers in that area, because without getting into too many details about it, it's just easier to buy corn than it is to grow it.
Why is local important to you?
I don't even think the word local is what we kind of go for anymore here.
regenerative agriculture?
It's, and I was talking to our general manager, Stephanie, yesterday about that. It's not even so much of where it comes from. It's more of like the why do I buy from these farms and these farmers and what their general practices behind it. And you could buy local food, you could buy local meats and stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're sticking to any type of, you know, good ethos, or they really think about how things are developed and how they source from and stuff. It's a compounding issue that is, there has to be some type of meaning behind it.
I was going to say, you can use Roundup and grain-fed cattle locally just like you can anywhere else, and you're exactly coming out with a nothing product, you know, fake food. So.
And
it's a great point. Yeah,
as long as there's still someone who takes the time to think about what they're growing for a specific reason, it's better than someone just going to a grocery store and buying something from Chile or Argentina or somewhere that is not within our food shed as the state of Virginia or even the regional coast.
So I know you've been out to visit quite a few of the farms that you partner with. And so for listeners who are wondering, you know, hey, well, what is it that's different, or what is it that you look for? Tell us what, some of the farms you visited, what you see on those farms and why you like the product and prefer to, you know, work with that kind of product in your kitchen.
Much like the majority of how I approach things in terms of, you know, I'm passionate about this, the owner's passionate about it, I think everyone at the restaurant kind of believes in what we're doing here. I go to the farmer or the farm or whatever their crop or whatever they're growing is, and kind of approach it in the same fashion. If I can have a conversation with them and there, and I can see that there's a strong connection with what they're doing, it not only makes myself feel good about purchasing from them, but it also kind of bleeds into their product. So Clay at Autumn Olive is very passionate about what he's doing, and that shows forth in his product and what he has available to for wholesale and for other restaurants to use from, and it's delicious. And the same thing goes with John Whiteside at Wolf Creek. He's quite the individual in terms of, I would have never expected him to be a cattle rancher given his background and everything else on top. And I think those staple kind of ideals is what food has been formed on, and that's the ideal foundation of how food is grown. And we've gotten so far removed from that idyllic foundation.
We have. I mean, it all starts with the soil.
Yes, and that I feel that I would say all of the farmers that I purchase from have those, understand that ideal of what it is that they're doing. They're not necessarily just growing produce. They're not just raising animals. There's a meaning behind that. There's a reason that they're doing it in the way that they're doing it, because obviously it is so much easier just to use Roundup. It's so much easier to buy cheap feed from, you know, GMO sources, and it's incredibly easy to do that in comparison to trying to do it regeneratively or organically, or in Whiteside's case or Clay Tranum's case, working within the confines of what they have available to them. I mean, Clay at Autumn Olive, he's got three different types of pasture setups, whether it's hardwoods or actual grasslands and things like that, and trying to utilize and raise pigs in an area like that that still has houses around and there's still neighbors and there's still a close proximity. And then you can have a conversation with John Whiteside about his vast rolling hills, and the neighborhood that has in his area is no longer, you know, what it was once was 50 years ago, with people coming in and tearing down trees and cutting grass. It doesn't have to be cut grass and trying to let it grow back to its original state without actually thinking about what you're doing in that aspect. I think the majority of the farmers that I purchase from approach it in the same fashion.
Yeah, they both talk. I don't know Clay. I've talked to him, but just from briefly talking to him, I think he also believes that the farm is a living organism as a whole, as opposed to, there's my pigs and, you know, they can, you know, eat this and I don't really care as long as I get my hogs and to weight, you know. So, but you're right. It's more of a culture of agri.
Rather than
just agriculture.
You're,
right?
You're trying to maintain a holistic ecosystem.
Yes.
And it's an ecosystem that you're introducing into, and this kind of touches upon, you know, agriculture as from its foundation and its core when we first came to North America and tried to bring ideals of European agriculture into an area that has never had that strength of agriculture. They do say that there was a form of agriculture within the indigenous tribes in the Americas in terms of crop burnings and how they were kind of foraging and doing things. And we brought these European ideals thinking, it's green, it's grassland, we can do the same exact thing. Yeah. And trying to adapt. Cattle's a huge one. These animals were never here to begin with. These are old, you know, European stocks that we brought over, whether it's from Europe or Spain, and trying to get them to adapt to an area that never been, versus having an animal like buffalo and bison that are indigenous, they're adaptable, they're incredibly good for this area. But of course, that's getting into more politics than agriculture.
It is, you're right.
And that
right.
aspect. But
so does that mean we're going to see bison on the menu soon? Or
unfortunately, there isn't that strong of a pull for bison.
There is a farm up in Rappahannock somewhere up there. Orange County.
Does bison, buffalo, and I think water buffalo as well. It is not a domesticated animal. It is still very
much. It's very good meat.
Very much a wild animal. So the price point for bison and buffalo is a little bit different.
Having been in the food business for a long time, one of the hurdles that I ran into was paying the proper price for pasture raised pork and for grass fed beef and pastured poultry. I couldn't. My price point would be too high for me to market it to the average customer.
You're listening to Your Health right here on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is MC Blair. Back to our interview.
Now, Michael tells me that one way that you've done it is by bringing in whole or half animals and doing the butchering yourself. Is that correct?
Yes. That issue is a very strong issue that I think everyone in the food service industry has to deal with any day of the week at this point. The food system in terms of how animals are raised and the price points and where all of those numbers come from is dauntingly scary. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly scary to think about what farmers actually get paid for commodity meats. And you can read reports, and I get old reports from, you know, some old food service reps that I used to work with, and it's like it's such an issue. So in order to combat that in terms of the price point with getting properly raised animals or pasture-raised animals is to essentially buy in bulk. And I don't mean, eight cases of something, or we're not even talking about casings.
Right, cases, exactly.
We're talking whole animals or half animals.
A whole or half animal, and trying to utilize as much of it as possible to kind of keep my price point on a fair level for myself, and then what do I can pass on to the consumer. The easiest way to look at it is if I pay, $3.10 or $3.50 a pound for this animal, everything on that animal is essentially $3.50 a pound, regardless of where it comes from.
Right.
And you gotta have to make that stretch as much as possible. So, for instance, the pork, all the fat is rendered down, and I don't necessarily gain any more money by using the rendered pork fat to cook with everything. I'm just kind of freeing up those funds because I don't
just better.
I don't have to purchase olive oils or cooking oils and use rendered pork fat. I can just kind of substitute it and kind of stretch and kind of free up dollars that would be kind of lost if you just got it already pre-done and already pre-cut. But again, there's nothing wrong with doing that. There's nothing wrong with purchasing pre-cuts. I mean, not everyone has the space, the time, or the education to be able to do that. I certainly didn't when I first started here, and this has been quite a learning experience in terms of starting with just a general concept with a pork loin, and like, well, we can find a use for the belly, we can find a use for the shoulder, and it's like, well, I might as well just get the whole thing because it ends up being cheaper to buy a half pig than it is just buy a shoulder and a belly or a belly loin combo type thing.
We are going to a break right now. We will be back shortly. And And we're back. This is MC Blair. You are listening to Your Health on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, the voice of resistance, right here in beautiful Charlottesville, Virginia. We are going to get back to our interview with Chef Jeff Deloff of Three Penny Cafe.
And I remember particularly with the beef, talking with John Whiteside, and he had some choice words about chefs and, you know, how particular we can be in terms of the cuts that we want and the consistency, and he was pretty much like, that's not how that works.
Nope.
Especially looking at a grass-fed animal, there is no kind of grading system with the USDA and everything else, and that's an issue in itself on a different topic, but it was pretty much like, you know, that's all you guys really want, and I kind of took that to heart and was like, okay, then I guess I'll start buying in larger quantities and figuring out what to do with it.
Yeah.
So the way that I approach it is it's not necessarily always about me as the chef or me about the restaurant in terms of convenience. This has to be a mutual relationship with the person that I buy from. So if it has to be a whole animal configuration because ultimately it's cheaper for them to provide a whole animal, whether they pay someone to break it down and package it and ship it and label it and all this other stuff, because those kind of add up.
They do.
Every piece of, you know, cryovac film that goes around a chop or something, you know, bones or whatever it is, you know, that's a dollar a piece.
So you're able to hang the beef and everything for aging purposes?
The legality of dry aging and things like that from a restaurant standpoint is quite a gray area, if you will. Technically, it's not something that I'm allowed to do because it's an uncovered piece of meat, like that. But on that retrospect, I do believe that Whiteside does hang his beef
at least a week or two weeks at his place. Yeah, he's got a 14-day hang.
Then by the time I get to it, you know, I run with such a small staff with a small space. I can't do the whole. I can break it down into smaller pieces in the day, and then it takes me a few days to kind of go even further into that to kind of break it down. Because not only am I butchering a half a steer, but I'm also preparing everything else in that aspect. So,
yeah.
I mean, I have to divide the time up wisely.
Sure.
But there is enough space in our walk-in because we do have a luxury that a lot of restaurants don't have, and is to have a fairly decent-sized walk-in. But meat delivery days, it kind of just, the walk-in fills up very, very quickly in terms of beef, pork, and lamb in there all together. But, yeah, it's easier to get my money's worth and the consumer's money worth if I buy in larger quantities and figure out how to use as much as I can as far as it'll go.
We certainly don't want to overlook the produce, the green stuff.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
But let's talk about produce, because I know your list of farms has certainly grown since you've started, for sure.
We do have
some amazing farms around here, some that are officially certified, like
Bel Air,
of course, Whisper Hill, Radical Roots, and all sorts.
Yeah.
But some that are not certified. And there again, so for you as a chef, who obviously is so focused on, you know, the cleanness of the food and, you know, no pesticides and all that, how do you determine, you know, who you're going to work with? Is that going to visit the farms, like a place like Pick Sweet Greens, because I've been there and I know that, you know, Claudia and Jim are amazing and their, you know, their food is just luscious and clean and all that. They're not certified, but, you know, just as good as a foreign that's certified. So how do you go about that process?
Well, I think the biggest thing when it comes to purchasing produce or anything in that aspect is the amount of dialogue that you're able to have. Obviously, you know, when you go to a grocery store or you buy from a large big box distributor, you don't have that conversation available to you. You don't have the ability to be like, what do you have this week? Or there's an issue or whatever the conversation might be. And that's kind of where I start. This past growing season, if I guess we can use that as a term, between the two markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays in Charlottesville, the one at Mead and the one at the actual downtown mall, and the culmination of the local food hub and some other phone calls throughout the week, I would say 90% of my produce came from the market in the food hub, if not 100% in that aspect. Yeah. Whether it's I'm talking to someone on the phone or I go and physically pick it up at these markets that day or I figure it out ahead of time. And it kind of gives more meaning behind what we do. And then obviously being able to speak with a farmer kind of opens up with, like, well, what do you have coming in the coming weeks? Like, what's in the pipeline? Like, how are you dealing with the drought that we've had this past year? And how does that look? What are you looking for in the future? And, you know, it, and that kind of breaks down with, like, you can kind of whittle out the ones that who may not be as truthful as they say they are. And that's not to say that I've had an experience with that, but that's not to say that it doesn't exist in terms of people just slapping a label on a box that they might have purchased from somewhere else. As much as I would like to visit all the farms that I purchased from, but that's great distances, and I appreciate that they are able to come closer to me, so to speak, whether it's delivery or meeting me at the market in that aspect. But I've been able to establish some formal relationships with these farms that I kind of started purchasing from this past year, and I look forward to continuing doing business with them come next spring. That's for certain.
Cool. Wow, that's really, really cool, Jeff. So what? How do you compensate, or how do you provide local produce in the wintertime?
So the one cool thing that we have available in Charlottesville is the local food hub.
Right, right.
Not only do they have the storage capacity to take in large amounts of produce from many different farmers, but they also have the storage capacity for things to kind of hang out during the winter months. And I kind of pushed it to the limit last winter, because that's when I really started using the local food hub in terms of, I didn't have my feet on the ground in terms of figuring out all the different farmers that I was purchasing from the year before. And as I've said, this is an ongoing process, but this past winter, I just bought everything from the food hub. Whether it's a lot of root vegetables, which it turns up being a lot of fruit, you know, fruit vegetables, lots of carrots and beets.
I was going to say, yeah, that's all in season, winter-wise anyway.
Yeah, anything that has a storage to it. But
right.
There's also a lot of other farms that have greenhouses or they have high tunnels that allows them to get produce throughout the wintertime.
And I know Michael at Planet Earth.
He's a great individual and is a great example of that. Wayside Produce is another excellent example.
Oh, okay.
In terms of the variety of produce that's available through the winter times and whatnot.
Is that in Greensboro or in Waynesboro?
It's up near Harrisonburg.
Yes.
Oh, in the valley there.
Yeah, it's in the valley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a neat little farm. Yeah, I've been up there.
Mennonite or?
Yeah, I believe.
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
So it's just a matter of planning ahead. And my other alternative is that if I can't get something local that has a good meaning behind it, so to speak, I always fall back on organics.
There you go.
So
yeah,
if it comes down to, you know, there's something's not applicable or there's just not availability to it, then that's when it gets difficult, because now I'm looking at a product that at least I can say is organic.
Yeah.
But there are other costs to it in terms of, A, it's a higher price point, but B, there we're talking about transportation costs and everything else that are attributed to it and the lead time and ordering and things like that. And that's kind of what our motto is with everything else. So if I can't get dairy from my local producers, then I'm going to get organic, certified organic dairy products, whether it's butter, half and half, things like that. At least I can depend on an organic market that I can kind of pull from. And that's kind of what we've started doing. If I can't get it locally or from a trusted source, then I'll just buy organic variants of it.
So any of you listeners out there that are looking for a great meal, either vegetarian or one with meat, and that really want the local, want clean food. Let's face it, just want clean food. This is definitely a place to come. Three Penny Cafe up on I guess, Market Street and...
West Main Street.
West Main.
Yeah.
I'll edit that.
I will add, too, through my work with Foodways, I'm gonna toot Jeff's horn right in front of him, because I'm sure he won't do it. And this is not to take anything away from a lot of outstanding chefs and restaurateurs in this town or anywhere, but what Jeff is doing here, along with Meropi, the owner of the restaurant, is truly among the best, not just in this town or in this state, but in the country. For those diehards who have heard of the likes of Alice Waters and other chefs around the country who are devoted to clean, organic food, Jeff's commitment here, his devotion, as he said, is truly outstanding nationwide, and that should be known. And I can say that, you know, of course, it is. There's an element of opinion, but through the work that I have done and my knowledge of the food system around this country, it is pioneering work. And so, listeners should know that.
That's quite the compliment, and yeah. I appreciate that. But with that being said, I don't think that I'm necessarily doing anything.
That's why you said you wouldn't say it.
Any different than anybody else would, whether it is the likes of those other great chefs. But I think what we're doing here is just trying to bring it back to kind of what we have, or take advantage at least of what we have available to us. And again, that's not to say that there aren't plenty of other options and other avenues that you can take in this industry. I'm just sticking with this one.
Well, you're doing a good job. I'm of the mind that it's about survival. It's about surviving. It's about being healthy. And when I say that, I don't mean, you know, one or two times a year you get a cold. I'm talking about, you know, if you're basically healthy, if the building blocks are basically there. And for my own self, eating clean food, I haven't gone. I used to get a cold or two a year, you know, or the flu once a year. And I haven't had any malady like that 10 or 15 years now, and it's because, and actually, I noticed you have Caramont Farm down here.
Yeah.
And it was Gail Hobbs Page of Caramont Farm. I've known her since Norfolk, when she was down as an executive chef of a friend of mine's restaurant, and she told me about eating clean food, real food. She told me slow food, I think it was called at the
yeah.
time, because that's how you cook the meat, slow and slow, you
yeah,
know,
that's right.
That's low temp for a long time, guys. Okay. and so ever since then, and she warned me, once you do this, your body won't let you go back. And a few times during that, I've actually eaten something from wherever, fast food or wherever restaurant that was, you know, conventional. And my body, I paid for that immediately within a day. So it's true. It really is true. And I applaud you for what you're doing here, Jeff.
Well, I appreciate that. Again, I like the path that we've kind of started to go down on, and I hope to continue this in the full capacity that we do now. And with the amount of stuff that is available here in Virginia and the other routes that you can take in terms of seafood and things like that that are now coming more to light, I don't see that why we can't, or why anyone can't do this for that matter.
I want to mention one other thing. I've heard people talk about coming, referring to grass-fed beef. They go, oh, wait a minute, man, that's kind of gamey. That grassy, gamey taste. Now, I've done some things where it's not true for me. What have you found when dealing with grass-fed beef,
so
taste-wise?
That statement, when it comes to grass-fed beef, and it goes along the same statement with, well, it tastes like chicken, pork is flavorless, we, as consumers, don't really know what grass-fed beef tastes like. So it's not that it's gamey, it tastes beefy, because that's what beef tastes like. What we're used to eating or associate with flavors with commodity raised animals is we're associated with eating corn. And that flavor. Now, and again, there's two rules of thought when it comes to grass-fed beef, and then there's grass-fed beef that is finished on corn, and then there are two thoughts of it in terms of, well, beef should only have grass, and that's all that they should eat. And there are other terms that it's okay for to finish the cattle on corn to give it that bulk flavor and to add that extra flavor to it. You know, there are conflicting reports on whether one is better than the other, or one is sustainable, one is not sustainable. And I finished reading Nicolette Nyman's In Defense of Beef. One of her talking points was, A, this is a woman that was vegetarian, and she does not eat beef still, and she wrote a book about defending beef in terms of why we should eat more of it. She brought up the fact that it's not net, that there isn't anything inherently wrong with finishing a cow on corn to get that corn flavor to it. But we associate an animal that is just strictly in a feedlot and essentially cuts their growth rate on grass in half. So if you finish, if you raise a cow on corn, it might take only a year to, you know, 15 months to bring it to slaughter weight, whereas a grass-fed cow takes 2 years, at least 2 years.
At least 2 years.
To get it up there. So you're looking at, again, it's not really a gamey flavor to it. You're just tasting what beef tastes like.
I know. And then just from what I've read and talked about with grass farmers, that the grain is, well, first off, it's, you know, starch and sugar and doesn't have a lot of food value to it. And the cows, the ruminant, can't digest it. And so they get acidosis and they're sick.
Essentially makes them sick. Their stomach is not developed to process grain like that.
You are listening to Your Health right here at 94.7 WPVC. We're listening to Jeff Deloff of Three Penny Cafe, along with my co-host, Michael Riley. And also, I want to interject there that the woman that he cited saying there wasn't inherently wrong finishing a cow with grain is absolutely incorrect, 100%. You should never, ever eat a piece of beef where the cow has been finished with grain or corn. She is incorrect. And we're going to take a little break right here. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be back. And we are back right here on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm MC Blair. You are listening to Your Health, the program where you learn the truth about real food, or the real truth about food, however you want to say that. We've got Jeff Deloff, the rest of his interview, and then our two-minute drill. And we'll go back to Jeff Deloff of Three Penny Cafe, along with my co-host, Michael Riley.
It ends up...
It ferments.
It ends up fermenting, and then the cattle actually gets its nourishment from the bacteria that eats the fermented hay in its stomach. So it's essentially raising its own food by eating grass, and then that's how it gets its nourishment from.
Well, that's it. I mean, you want to get scientific, you know, the...
I'll just jump in and say, you know, the issue that I try to talk to people about is it really goes beyond the what's on the plate and the taste and, you know, all that. It's really an ecological issue now. And of course, those out there that want to do away with eating all animals, will point to the environmental impact. And, you know, the way I often counter that is by, you know, explaining to people that a system like John Whiteside of Wolf Creek or Highland Orchard, where it is 100% grass, that they actually can have a very positive environmental impact by sequestering carbon through managed holistic rotation.
Yes, with an extreme rotational pasture.
And I don't disagree that, you know, eating a piece of corn-finished beef is not necessarily going to kill you right away, but it is a slippery slope, just because, you know, you're getting now into some environmental issues that are, you know, sort of a red flag, and these are the things that a lot of people are concerned about in terms of, you know, once you start feeding them corn, you are at some point, for the most part, having to confine the animals. I think there are some very small farms that will feed them out in the field, but most farms are starting to confine them, and then you have manure issues, and then of course you have the feed issue. You know, where is the feed coming from? Is it GMO? Is it, you know, being sprayed with glyphosate? Is it, you know, being shipped from somewhere else? Or, you know, so again, it's a bit of a slippery slope, but we're sort of digressing.
I think you're right. Yeah.
But it's important for, you know, I think for those issues, and it's why I'm so passionate about, you know, encouraging any restaurant or any participant in the food system to, you know, think beyond these issues. And that's what, you know, I've been trying to do is, you know, it is important from a human standpoint what we eat, but it's greater than that. It goes beyond that. And, you know, these farms are, you know, when they farm, they think about those issues. They think about the land. They think about the ecology. And, you know, I know, you know, again, Clay Trainum is another good example. Raising pigs and, around his property is, you know, he's thinking about his land as much as his animals. And that's what's makes
Well, it is. It is. And then, of course, if you're eating real food, clean food, and you're less sick, there'll be less type 2 diabetes, less obesity, on and on and on. You have a healthier community and less missed days at work and probably more positive attitude because you're not sick all the time.
And it's not – it branches more than just on an individual level. If you continue to eating within the amount that's in the food shed, for instance, in regional Virginia, not only are you supporting an ecosystem, you're also supporting an economy.
Yeah, the whole community, yes, absolutely.
It supports the community, so not only are you as an individual eating healthily, but you're also getting people to eat within their own confines,
right,
of understanding where food comes from, and it's not that you can just roll up to a grocery store and be like, okay, this is all that's what's available to me because that's the only thing that I can get at a grocery store. And that's what it essentially boils down to. And not only just what we do here, but on a much larger scale with what's available in the community. It's if you buy clean food, if you buy healthy, locally grown food, you are supporting a much larger picture than just, you know, yourself.
Yeah, I know we're running low on time, but when we're talking about clean, healthy food, I know gluten is a big issue with Merope, the owner, and so you're also very focused on the type of grains you get and what you do with your grains, and I know you're excited. How much time do we have here? We're down at...
I can edit.
Yeah, well, tell us just quickly, if you can, about, you know, I know you're working with locally with Woodson Mills and Nansen Mills down in South Carolina, and, you know, so you're passionate about almost everything.
And I'll try to condense this as much as I possibly can.
Okay.
The wheat that we're used to eating or the wheat that's available to us in stores, whether it's prepackaged sliced bread or even bread that's baked at the store, is not what wheat traditionally is. These are not the same type of wheat that we started raising or we started to cultivate, in the sense that it was not all level. It had to be rotated. You know, crops had to be rotated in order to maintain the same level of foods and things like that. So it's incredibly important in terms of your own health and the preservation of ancient grains.
You are listening to Your Health right here at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are listening to an interview that my co-host Michael Riley and myself had with Jeff Deloff at the Three Penny Cafe. And back to our interview.
In existence, because the way that the food system works now, it is very difficult to find good wheat, good whole wheat, good rye, and actually be able to taste what those grains are supposed to be like. So I purchased from Anson Mills, which is an organic granary, if that's even the right word, because he contracts farmers to raise ancient grains organically to preserve these ancient forms of agriculture, whether it's stone-ground grits or whether it's old forms of rye or old forms of wheat, whatever it may be, he does it sustainably and organically. And there's a huge difference in comparatively speaking, texturally, look-wise, and taste-wise, if you take commodity whole wheat and you take whole wheat grown by someone who is trying to grow wheat the way that wheat is supposed to be grown, whether or not the hybridized version that we're used to, the differences are outstanding, and they're very prevalent. They're very noticeable what whole wheat looks like from a reputable source versus what you can buy at the store.
So you're baking your bread from these ancient grains? Or
I actually purchase bread from Little Hat Creek Farm, and they use organic grains, whether it's whole wheat or corn, and they do their own sourdoughs. And we also purchase bread from Rivette, who also does another fantastic job in terms of bread baking. You're only taking the next step and trying to get away from, you know, pre-measured and pre-bought stuff in the grocery store if you start buying from a local bakery. You'll see the differences immediately just by switching from a grocery store and then, you know, either going to ABC, which is next to us, or Rivette, or trying to find these smaller bakeries. You can instantaneously see a difference.
And I want to interject right there. It's absolutely true. When you go and you buy that loaf of white bread, it's not really bread. It's mostly sugar and carbohydrates. The benefits of the whole flour has been stripped away. And anything baked with all-purpose flour is actually a waste of time. I know I maybe step on some toes there, but it's just not good. You just have to go with completely whole grain and hopefully locally sourced, which is a little difficult, but at least get whole grain and always bake with whole grain flour so that you get the maximum nutrition from your baked goods. Back to our interview.
So in terms of what I do with them, whether it's grits, we make our own pizza crust out of different grains, whether it's whole wheat, buckwheat, rye, and corn. And then I make pastas out of the different flours that are available, or pastries and bread flours. And I just started making our own ramen noodles.
Yeah, I see that. That's a good
in-house
ramen.
With stuff from Anson Mills. But they also do farro and wheat berries and ancient varietals of field peas. And just researching Anson Mills on itself is quite an interesting story.
Is Woodson Mills in the valley? Is that?
No, they're down in Nelson County.
He's in Nelson. Yeah.
What's the one in the valley?
No, that's
So Woodson Mills sources local
non-GMO
grains, and then they grind it stone ground.
Yeah, they're working with a farm now called the Keenbell Farm out near Richmond, and they're growing some organic heirloom grains.
And I think he has one of the oldest stone mills.
He does. Yeah. It's a pretty cool place.
In the state.
Yeah.
And so he's, you can get those through the food hub. I think the food hub actually takes care of the distribution for it. And I use all the products that's available to me through the food hub. So his rye, the whole wheat, the buckwheat, and then the corn grits and the cornmeal by them as well. So not all corn is inherently bad.
Understand. Totally understand.
There's good corn out there.
Their grits are outstanding.
There's good corn when it's done right, and it's also harder to do. So I give props to the farmers that actually take the time to grow good corn versus GMO super corn. And that's an entirely, entirely different conversation.
Well, I just wanted to thank you, Jeff. It seems like you're really doing something. That doesn't seem like you are. You're living our passions at any rate, as far as clean food and bringing a real food product, a nutritious food product to the public. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. I'm not necessarily doing it as a a religious pilgrimage, if you will, with it. But it's just something that I'm passionate about, and that everyone here is passionate about, and I think that shows forth and with everyone here at the restaurant.
Well, it just shows people and our listeners and other restaurateurs out there that it can be done.
It can be. It, absolutely, yeah. And I think the last thing I would add, we did get a chance to talk about it, but you guys are, I believe, one of, if not the only, certified Seafood Watch restaurant in Virginia for sustainable seafood. So, again, what's amazing, again, and Maropi, and the owner, and you, and the rest of the staff are so committed to all facets of the food on the menu. So, again, yeah, my thanks to you for doing this and making it available to us in Charlottesville, who are lucky enough to come dine here, which I'll be doing tomorrow night. So,
all
thanks.
Right.
I'll
look forward to it. Thanks, Chef.
Thank you.
Appreciate
thank you so much. Yeah.
Boy, I tell you, that was one great interview. I suggest that you check out Three Penny Cafe. Absolutely. Well, we're down to our two-minute drill, and we have been hearing on To Your Health and from other sources that the demand for organic food is growing. And, of course, eating organic food is healthier because it has no chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides. And now we hear that the toxic administration in Washington might deregulate what organic is and is not, leaving you, our dear listeners, and me too, in a wasteland of confusion about what to believe. As the weeks roll by and Twitter storms erupt daily, nobody knows what to expect from our federal government. And quite frankly, reading the news can lead to stress overload. And we always know that stress can lead to early heart or digestive and brain problems. Can't we all just get along? I'd like to know. Well, the answer is yes, we can. It's all about community-based agriculture. Brings us together, provides a common ground between folks from different cultures and backgrounds. It strengthens and gives voice to the people who, before now, had none. And most importantly, provides the healthy food we crave and need for our bodies. And just imagine, if we could feed all or most of the local population with real food and not be dependent on outside political or corporate forces for our nutrition. Unbelievable. Wouldn't that be great? Because the profit-only motivation, corporate food, is keeping us sick and driving the true cost of food to unsustainable levels. Imagine a life with 70% less copays for doctor's visits because we're healthier. Very few incidences of hours lost due to sick days. A life with more energy and increased production at work, leading to less stress and promotions or pay raises. How about that? That's always good. And these rewards can be achieved by supporting programs like City Schoolyard Gardens and the other programs within the Food Justice Network, attending or going to the local restaurants that are committed to bringing real food, like Three Penny Cafe or the Whiskey Jar down in, or the Rev Soup and other places, Rebecca's Maya Restaurant. There are other places that also do it. I urge you to give your time and money to many of the Food Justice Network organizations and start your journey to a healthier and rewarding life. Thanks for listening, and my heartfelt thanks to Michael Riley, my co-host, and, of course, Chef Jeff Deloff of the Three Penny Cafe. And remember, eating real food, wearing a smile, and keeping a positive attitude are keys to your health.